Joining us back on the show are the co-founders of Emergence, Sean Mishka and Tyler Yerby.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Right now, our sessions are, like I said, in a separate building. Would you have, you know, most of your sessions with your strength coach, you know, in the practice field? Like, what percentage of it would it be, you know, for us on the sand versus, you know, where there's lots of weights?
That's a great question. I will give you a percentage, I promise, because it is easier for people. I'll make it short, but it is easier for people to kind of grasp when you do give percentages. But you said something there that is a great point. People forget that you develop strength and power in areas outside of the weight room as well. So I know that's a lot of times what strength conditioning coaches are focused on, but it can be done in ways that are very, very different than what you traditionally see. So it could be stuff that is done on a court. It could be in a different area using different implements, tumbling, crawling, jumping, moving in different ways. Like I obviously want to give you a handful of practical examples. So with athletes of mine, they may be in like a duck walk type position, but they're exploring different heights and they're picking up different people around them. They're navigating and weaving through traffic. Well, that's a form of, and I know it's not a true isometric hold, but it's a form of an isometric hold that you may see exist in a strength conditioning realm. So with that percentage, I think there is a time and a place for it. Volleyball specifically, I mean, with the athletes that you're working with, both male and female across the board, you're going to be working with a lot of taller athletes, or for the most part, the ones I've worked with in the past, because I did work with strength conditioning at the University of Minnesota when I was in grad school, actually, with the volleyball team. And they were very tall, most of them taller than me. And I'm 6'2". But anyways, I would say percentage-wise, maybe 60% in the weight room and 40% somewhere different. Now, that somewhere different could be the court, but that somewhere different could be the sand. It could be a grass field, but I like the idea of the rep without rep and changing the environment, because you're also influencing how the athlete's then going to be motivated, how the athlete's intentions are going to flow. And it allows for them to have to problem solve in different ways, because I do view everything is problem solving, even if I'm in the weight room, if I'm on the court, if I'm in the sand. And if we take that lens, or if we view it with that lens, then they're always going to be looking for ways to move uniquely and move organically to them.
That's great. Yeah, you can't tell on Zoom, but Andrew is 6'10", so volleyball players are tall.
That's what I meant by, like, I was 6'2". And actually, a real quick, funny side story. They were testing their approach. And I, that could go, take us down an entirely different rabbit hole as far as assessment and testing, which we can at least peek in there if you want. Yeah. But I remember the day that I got a chance to meet the entire team. This was back, oh gosh, year wise, this would have been 2010. And I remember they were testing, and the current strength and conditioning coach at the time, the one that Sean was actually consulting with, or just, that's how we met, like he said, she was like, "Do you want to go?" And I was like, "Not after how high they're touching." Like, it was just incredible. And I realized quite very quickly that I'd played Division II football, and we didn't have a volleyball team, but I realized very quickly these were some of the most elite humans on the planet.
Well, that's not Andrew, but he's tall, so don't worry. No.
Yeah, I'm 50% of it, but not the other half.
The tall part.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you touched on some ways to help bridge the gap of understanding of the sport, because most movement specialists, strength coaches, you know, did not play sport X that they are then assisting with at a university or even at a high school club, whatever. What ways do we help to bridge that gap?
I think first and foremost, I know I mentioned and touched on it earlier, is just opening the affordance, if you will, you know, opening the door. I see oftentimes there's a huge disconnect between the sport coach and the strength and conditioning professionals. And what we hope is that both can come across their respective bridge to allow their bridge to become more intertwined and interwoven just a little bit more. Hopefully, you know, you get invited to his facility in the same, his or her facility, in the same way that you're inviting him or her to your space and facility, whether it be the beach or the court. And I think that's the first place to start that most coaches actually never really take the step of doing. You know, they think that the other person is doing something that maybe they are or are not. They have this certain connotation. They might even see the program and automatically assume they know what's being done. But start asking more questions and having this two-way dialogue. I know it sounds intuitively obvious, but when I consult with programs, and as we do at Emergence here, programs of all kinds, everything from private facilities to high school coaches of all kinds of sorts to college to professional. And I so often see this lack of communication that if we just started there, and we started kind of discussing things from our own form of life. Again, what we think, what we believe, how we behave within our environments, all of a sudden some things could, you know, some paths could converge as opposed to being more divergent as they often are.
I'll give you a couple other things there because I love all of that. But I think the first thing, maybe you ask the strength and conditioning coach. Okay, you ask them, give them a play, or you give them a 2-minute clip of a few different exchanges, and you ask them what they're seeing, you know, from your team. You know, how do you feel as though we are going about solving these problems, performing, whatever the language is you want to use? And yes, you're asking more to see if they're curious, but then they then have to start investigating the sport even more so. And then that's where opens up that dialogue for, like, maybe they see something that you don't. Maybe they're able to bring their insight as far as their experiences with said athlete into the conversation. And then the coach learns more about the tendencies of that particular individual. Maybe it's their motivation levels. Maybe it's where their intentions may flow at times in the weight room or in the weight room setting. But in doing so, you're inviting the coach into where they feel as though that they're maybe more involved or more, you know, they're a part of the program. And I'm not saying you two by any means, John Andrew, don't get me wrong, but I will tell you, I've been involved with programs before where I know the coach respected myself and other strength and conditioning coaches, but we were low men on the totem pole because we weren't the position coach. But we are all working for the same thing. And quite frankly, and this goes back to the point I was making earlier, and this is specifically within football. I mean, we had more time by far with the athletes than the position coaches did, by far. Mm-hmm. So you bet that we know them really well, but what are we doing with that time? And so those are some simple things that I would do is just make sure that they feel value, number one. Number two is that asking them to kind of break down a play or two or three, and then opening up that dialogue. And the last thing I will say, and this is just more of a, you know, in my opinion, I don't have tons of evidence to support this, but let's think about all sports, but specifically volleyball. When someone's hiring a head coach or a panel or board is hiring a strength conditioning coach, sometimes they get someone that's a big power lifter. I've been proven to increase strength or whatever it may be, which is a really small piece of the puzzle. Important, but very small. And then a lot of times they hire someone that is from the sport of volleyball, which can be helpful. I personally would just hire someone that's curious. And why I say that, if they're curious, they will learn a heck of a lot about that sport.
Yeah, that's a great point. I like how you brought in some co-design there, even when working with staff members. I think it's everywhere, right? I mean, that's awesome.
I can't get away from it. And I'll tell you the reason why. I realized for far too long I was trying to teach athletes across populations how to move, and every athlete had to move the exact same way, regardless of age, skill level, whatever it may be. And I realized how asinine that was. And I honestly, I sat down, I thought about it, and I'm like, where can I start initially? I can start by just asking them what they think and seeing how their actions answer me, more importantly, but also how their experiences are involved.
Well, and I would think on that note as well, something that sometimes can be somewhat irritating as a coach, but yet should be, again, expected, anticipated, or desired, would be to ask why. Why are you doing what you're doing? And I think the more you open up that dialogue to come back the other way, specifically because many within strength and conditioning aren't going to be overly well-versed in many of the ideas that you two are. Or hopefully some of the other listeners out there taking a more ecologically friendly or valid approach, if you will, I think you'll start to open up those lines of communication and they're going to be like, wait, what is all this variability doing here? Mm-hmm. You know, even just thinking about something like jump performance. One thing, if I could do it over again, when Tyler and I met, I was a technical model type of individual when Tyler and I met in 2009, 2010. where I was brought in essentially to consult with the program in regards to how jump performance and specifically jump execution was unfolding. But if I would be able to do it over again, I would be injecting much of that, which what we've talked about over the last 45, 50 minutes here, which would be more variability, more authenticity, less adherence to technical models, and less rote repetition or decontextualized work just as a whole.
Yeah, that's great. So I want to open up the little bit of the rabbit hole you opened up, Tyler, with what should we measure? You know, right now, I think traditionally you measure what, how much I can squat this week versus last week or bench press, especially in the strength and conditioning world. Do you think there's anything that's, you know, worth measuring from that? Like if I'm a strength and conditioning coach, yeah. What is your take on that?
Yeah, that's definitely a rabbit hole. Let's go down it and let's explore. Let's peek in for a little bit.
Tell us what to do.
Oh man. I will tell you this. I think that sometimes whenever I'm asked this question, whether it's in person or on podcasts, it may come across that it's not valuable. It's still important. It's still very important for them to squat and for them to lunge. It's just doing it in different ways. And so when we start looking at what are we testing and what is that information telling us, I'll start with a very short story. And I won't say the university, I've been at several. We used to measure someone's ability to play the game based on what they were hang cleaning, how much they were squatting. And it was just like, we're literally like, does it really matter whether he squatted 450 or whether he squatted 460? I mean, he like, regardless, it's just, it's hard to then say now so-and-so should play. So what do I actually feel about testing specifically within the weight room? I don't test anything now, but I know exactly what they're doing because we're writing down. So I can look back and take a peek and see like, okay, like the facility I was at prior, like what did they do 2 months ago? But I care about who they are right now. And I care more about how they're performing on field and the functional fit for the football athletes, or in this case in volleyball, like how they're performing. If we feel as though that to use S&C language here, their eccentric strength is weak. How am I evaluating that? Are they getting stuck in positions whenever they are digging a ball? Okay. Are they getting stuck in a position whenever they're trying to explode out into a jump? So evaluating in that lens and caring more about that metric. And that's a very, very subjective, obviously you're analyzing as a coach. That's more important than whether they can squat 300 or whether they can jump X amount of feet. Now, can you test them? Yes, you definitely can. If you feel as though that testing something is going to make it maybe more comfortable because the head coach wants to know those numbers, you certainly can. But I honestly don't think that there's a lot of value in placing a tremendous amount of time in testing, because we could be placing time elsewhere. And if you've heard me say anything over this past 55 minutes to an hour, we're all limited by time. So why am I going to spend that time testing them on 17 different tests that quite frankly are going to change substantially anyway, especially if we're talking about high school to collegiate level athletes, that they're the time scale of learning and their rates of development and everything's going to change. They may go up on a test despite what you're doing with them because they grew. Or they're more fatigued the day they tested before. So I think that part's really challenging. So I honestly don't test anything personally. The only time that I guess I shouldn't say I don't do anything. The only time I will is if I am working with athletes and I know they're going off to play at so-and-so university, and I know their coach wants to know what they have been doing, I might do it the last day. And the funny thing is I'll get questions like, oh, well, what were you doing? How often were you testing this? How often were you jumping? I'm like, well, we jump all the time. We actually never tested this until the last day. Mm-hmm. And you usually get this kind of puzzled look like, well, they improved. Well, of course they improved, because we took a variable rep without rep approach. And that's why their figures went up.
Would you consider something like arm speed, you know, like, I mean, baseball measures velocity, right? We can see if that's, you know, that seems a little bit, at least, you know, obviously that's like part of the game versus like how much you can bench press. So for us, you know, we can measure like how fast someone could hit a ball. Is that worth, you know, trying to measure that?
Where I was actually going to go, John, is this, and it works for this question as well. Perfect. Is if we keep the mantra or this idea that context drives content, and there's this mutual reciprocal relationship between the unfolding confluence of constraints and how that individual coordinates or organizes their movement behavior, we realize that strength should be contextual, right? And so you're speaking to a little bit more of that contextual strength. But yet what we find even in your question to a certain degree is a more technical orientation, right? Like, is arm speed going to actually correlate? Is it going to transfer to increase skill when that arm moves forward in similar ways? And my answer would be, now, more and more and more with every passing year, I believe there's less correlation there, as long as we're talking about a relatively higher or even moderate level of mastery or skill of athlete. And so we just view skill totally different than that. Like, what we find is skill is more context specific technique in the display and execution of it, either from a strength or motor ability characteristic standpoint, our effectivities in ecological dynamics terms, our action capabilities are all going to be dependent on the context and the constraints present. So, you know, your analogy kind of holds true for even jump performance, right? Like, when Tyler and I first met, I came in and I had an accelerometer and I had a jump mat, and I was testing the girls, not only jump height from all different kinds of scenarios or situation, a bunch of different contexts, but most of them, even an approach jump, didn't actually transfer, at least in my opinion, as much as it could or should, because all of a sudden, when that context opens up and there's more interacting component parts, essentially it's a more complex system. When there's either another person on your side, if we're talking about a 2-versus-2 situation, or if we're talking about 6-versus-6 type on a court, all of a sudden the context that drove that content looks, feels, acts, and behaves considerably different. So we don't see, say, maybe the same arm speed, just as we don't see the same jump performance, whether it's in ground contact time, whether it's in approach speed, or even in touch height.
And what you're hearing here is you're hearing the test or this speed, we've heard speed mentioned a few times, you're hearing game speed. And game speed's more than just an action metric that's being measured. Game speed is also what they're picking up. Because if I had the ability, you mentioned like the ball and how hard the ball can be hit, certainly valuable. It's a part of it. Do I need to test it? If you want to, you can. But look at in game, okay, with an athlete, you may find an athlete that hits the ball relatively hard, but not the hardest, is actually killing more balls and more shots because they're picking up these opportunities for action in said places to actually hit the ball. So they're actually searching, and as they're in midair, and then they're able to find the right place to hit the ball. So now it's game speed, or in this case, volleyball speed. And I do want to make one more mention. You mentioned the sport of baseball, and I'll apologize to the listeners out there. I actually do know a fair amount about volleyball, but I do know more about baseball. So I can give you an example from there. And then you guys can all take the knowledge you have in volleyball, and hopefully there's something we can take out of this. You mentioned arm speed. So there are tons of technologies that are used within baseball. There's spin rate, there's the different arm slots, and all these different ideas and things they're looking at. Let's say that you find that the pitcher is giving up more hits when their spin rate is between A and B. That information to me is very valuable. Why? Because now I want to design problems for them where they are then having to work through throwing that type of pitch, which is usually going to mean it's going to have that type of spin rate, to a varying amount of batter, different types of batters in under across conditions. And then you're then challenging them to have that repetition without repetition. And they can then go about finding ways they can be more effective with that pitch, and maybe by changing the spin rate, but they're doing it and it's all coupled together. So within the sport of volleyball, if there's ways for you guys to use technology that you have, but looking at it more in practice or in game, I know I'm saying in game a lot, but you can do this in practice.
Sure.
That stuff's far more valuable than just a decontextualized, isolated, let's see how hard they can hit it, because that once again uses time. And I bet you some of the people that throw, you know, or hit a volleyball or throw a baseball the absolute fastest, they're not all making millions and millions of dollars. There's a lot of people, to go back to baseball, they can throw the ball 95 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. But not a lot can throw 95 miles an hour with good control across conditions.
Right. So I've heard this pushback when I've talked to some strength and conditioning coaches about trying to be more representative and doing maybe some integrated practice, like integrate our, you know, with some aqua bags and do some of the movements that we do in a game. And the pushback was, well, won't there be overuse? Like, they're already playing so much, and then you're going to have them, like, their strength and conditioning workout's going to be doing the same movements. well, that, you know, that, that could lead to more injury and overuse. What do you guys say to that?
I will jump in there and then Tyler will be able to back me up as well. I think it goes back to a theme that sort of has emerged naturally within the last hour, which would be oriented around variability and this inherent characteristic of a human movement system, where no two solutions are ever going to be the same to begin with. And if we are trying to go down paths, and it doesn't matter who you are, I mean, we've all heard sort of this quote or cliche that you never stand in the same river twice. The same thing, I believe, applies with it facing any movement problem as well, or executing any movement. You're never the same each time that you face a certain movement problem, right? Or again, even if it's something highly decontextualized, by just changing certain nuances and aspects, even if we're talking about something maybe, say, as traditional as a barbell squat, we could talk about changing the load in the position of it. We could talk about changing the actual value, the quantitative value of the load. And this is going to change execution. We could talk about changing stance width. We could talk about changing stagger. We could, you know, and all of a sudden people are like, wait a minute, you're going to have us do a barbell squat where we're in a staggered stance? Absolutely, because likely the human movement system is going to probably find itself in these said positions and executing through these patterns on the court way more frequently than if their feet are parallel. We could talk about changing depth and range of motion, tempo and pace, even just changing it up rep to rep to rep in such a fashion creates this, what we believe at Emergence, to be a more anti-fragile movement system where it embraces this variability and it wants to exist there. So that whole idea of overuse, even you just talked about the aqua bags. Anybody who's ever worked with any of those and felt the way that the water sloshes around knows that probably no two reps, even if you are trying to do it in the exact same fashion, no two reps feel the same. And so I think it's kind of a cop-out for them to do their normal thing in many cases. And hopefully your strength and conditioning coach that would be listening this potentially is somewhat open and doesn't take too much offense to that. But that's usually what we find is they just want to adhere to that, which what they've always done, because that's the way they've always done it.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So we touched on this a little bit, but this is another kind of, I think, challenge. I'm curious how you guys address, it seems like in an informational processing approach in the traditional approach, it's just really easy to work with big groups. Like I have, you know, these set exercises, I know how they're supposed to move, I can demo it, everyone go. And when we treat each person as an individual, right, there's different problems to solve and maybe different activities, different constraints to give them opportunities to solve those problems. But if I have 30 people, like how do I do that? So yeah, I guess, how do you guys get around that big issue of treating everyone, you know, as having new problems to solve when you have 30, 40, 50 people?
Really good question. I love it. I will say that Rich White, who's a team member here at Emergence, he used to push back and push back to Sean, like, oh, I don't, it's just so much harder with big groups. And then you can hear from him, but I'll share kind of the same ideas here. It's actually easier with larger groups. I struggle whenever I only have one or two or three athletes, because the scale of representativeness, if you think about the game being 10 and one being the furthest thing from the game, let's say I'm trying to or like to exist in that kind of 4 to 6 that day with my athletes, I might not be able to because I only have two bodies out there. And so what used to be, or what I used to view as a burden, was actually a blessing in the fact that now I had, you know, because behavior affords behavior, right? And it influences one another. And so if that's the case, then I need to have a, you know, an opposition on the other side, because how I go about hitting the ball is going to change based on the bodies that are in that space. So when you have more bodies, and if it's 30 and you have different courts that are available, that's kind of what I was alluding to earlier when we were talking about the camps, to where you have some 2v3s. I know you're like, well, that's not how volleyball is played. Well, I understand that. But the point being is that the complexity is scaled to where it's a little bit less difficult for the athletes at that time, that may meet them where they are. So you can use, if you have different courts, use the space in that way. And then I will also add to that, to where, and how do I, I'm trying to think how to actually word this, how to package this together. But basically, by saying that you want to have fewer athletes to use this approach, you're not going to give the athletes an opportunity to still have contextual activities occur. And what I mean by that is, you used to say, like, you may be designing an activity for one single athlete, or maybe it's three or four on the court that are the better players, let's say, or the ones that you're targeting in that particular session. The other athletes are still getting contextual work. So even though that the activities may be designed for these three or four, and you have 15 to 30 out there, the other athletes are still getting contextual work. So my point being is that it happens to me very often where I might have 9 athletes, 10 athletes in the field, but the activities were designed or co-designed for maybe 2 or 3 of them, but they're still getting that contextual work.
Yeah. And if I could just jump in there, John, to elaborate a little bit more from my perspective or point of view, you mentioned on the previous question that this is a pushback that you often get. Now, this very question is a pushback that I've often gotten, because, of course, I work with players, NFL players, typically in a smaller group type of fashion. And coaches will tell me, well, that's fine and dandy. You only have 4 in your session. So obviously you can design these problems with a little bit more fine-tuned, detailed lens. But the thing that I want the most, more than anything, is actually more athletes. And the reason why I say that is, again, you've heard a trend throughout the last hour plus of us chatting in regards to more emergent movement problem solving. Well, the easiest way to gain more emergent movement problem solving that is of more variable or diverse nature to potentially tap into the abundance of the movement system for that respective performer, where they can interact with an alive movement problem specifically oriented around the opponent. Again, remember J.J. Gibson mentioned behavior affords behavior, which would just indicate that that opponent is a key vital informational source, or at least their behaviors are, for that behavior that our performer is going to attempt to organize and coordinate. So if we can present more variable movement problems through a diversity of opponent behaviors, this is probably the most valuable thing we can do. So again, I mentioned, you know, kind of calling people out with a cop-out. This is the biggest cop-out that I find. And it's probably the biggest pushback that I get. Tyler knows that I get pretty fired up about this, as the listener probably can tell as well, because I get it from NFL coaches. And they're like, I can't do that with my position group. I can't do that with my defense. Only you can do that because you're working in a more individualized way. But I believe it's the group that actually would allow that more emergent movement problem solving and the more live movement problem solving to actually exist.
I'm glad we got you fired up there.
I was just also going to add one thing there. It's really good for them to have to go against different people as well. So even though it may be designed for these 2 or 3 athletes, like, changing bodies, because they're all going to move in different ways, is going to give different opportunities or give rise to different opportunities for action. So that part's really important too. And I just want to make the mention one more time how important this is. And this has been the feedback I've gotten from coaches across different sports. Once they realize, like, oh, I can still use this approach, but maybe I'm designing the activities for, like I said, these 3 or 4, but the others are still getting really valuable work, and they're becoming sensitive to the information that they're perceiving, which is contextual information and valuable information for their system to become sensitive to.
Yeah.
Well, and because I am still fired up, and I will be fired up for the listeners out there, I will be fired up well after we're off of this call now as well. But I just wanted to use a little analogy or an anecdote, if you will. I've talked to a lot of martial arts instructors or coaches, sifus, if you will, that kind of discuss some of these ideas of alive movement problem solving with me. And even though some within martial arts, specifically the more traditional ones, do a little bit more rote repetition than that which what I would desire, I find it really ironic that most martial arts, when you talk about earning a black belt, they will throw people in these like alive sessions where the person, in order to earn said black belt, again, and this applies to some martial arts, not all. So I know that some people are going to, you know, get some pushback here as well, but we look at some such as say BJJ or jiu-jitsu, to where you have to go against opponent after opponent after opponent after opponent. And we're talking for like 50 to 70 opponents back to back to back to back, and show that you can carry out said quote unquote technique, which we would refer to as skill if it's more alive and you have to solve that problem in front of you, because every single one of those opponents, again, is going to have different behaviors. So that should tell us right there, in a sport that is typically highly traditionally oriented, meaning the majority of martial arts, they're still understand the value of, you know, more bodies will equate to better movement problems.
Yeah, no, that's great. It makes a lot of sense. I'm glad I asked and got you fired up. So we've been doing this podcast for, I don't know, 6 years or so. And I always offer the questions and the guests always take the questions like, yeah, you know, I'll see it so I can prepare. I think you were the first two who were like, no, we want to explore. We don't know what, want to know what's ahead. Why do you guys take that approach? Isn't it, I don't know. Isn't it nice to prepare and know what's coming?
It definitely is to a certain extent, but the reason why we do that, and Sean, I will say that Sean's the one that kind of inspired that even more so than me initially, or inspired me to be open and willing to do so, is the same reason why our company is titled what it's titled, the same reason why we've been discussing these ideas of emergent skills or the emergence of skill, to where we're gonna have somewhat of an idea, just knowing that it's a volleyball podcast, number one. I've listened to several of the episodes before, so kind of just the dialogue, gonna be how things flow. So there is some knowledge about the situation, okay, to borrow from JJ Gibson, but there's knowledge about the situation, but it's neat to know, to not know anything, because you're gonna get a more authentic answer that way. And you get a chance to, and I'll just be honest, it's in a selfish way, it just sharpens my sword, it challenges me, to then get better at answering said questions, or at least offering options, if you will, versus it being like I have everything scripted and written down and I said it perfectly, but then I get out in the real world and I can't actually apply these ideas. Because yeah, one thing I will tell you is it's awesome to have an underpinning theory. I mean, you have to have an underpinning theory, but the reason why is it informs how you go about being and doing and how you apply these activities in the real world. And so Sean and I, as you well know, obviously run Emergence. And one of the offerings we have is called the Movement Academy. It is a truly emergent academy where we are challenged like this on a regular basis. And we make plenty of mistakes, which is how we're able to go about getting better and better. So we like to be kept in the dark, if you will, so we get a chance to challenge ourselves even more so.
Yeah. And if I could just come on in the back of that, because it probably did seem weird at first when I emailed that response to you initially.
That's awesome.
But we try to embrace this form of life as much as we probably can, you know, as much as we appropriately can. And even when we put together Underpinnings, which was our initial course offering, which was literally 5 hours of Tyler and I standing in front of a computer. Now, we had slides, but we didn't rehearse one iota. We literally wanted to put our skill, if you will, to the test in an emergent fashion. And I don't say that to gloat. What we do is we want to live and breathe this problem solver mentality. Mm-hmm. And in order for us to kind of meet our athletes where they are, they need to know that we are sort of softly assembling ourselves and our own behaviors in that way as well. And I think it has not only allowed us to sharpen our sword, but it actually allows us to be put to our challenge point in many cases, in many ways as well. And we can go back and use this as a learning opportunity, because we will have made plenty of mistakes, as the listeners know, as they listen to this as well.
The last thing I'll add, and I, for all the listeners out there, I'm like chuckling, getting an opportunity to actually say this. I'll listen back to podcasts that I've done. I'm like, what did I say? What was that? What did I mean by that? Like, that doesn't even make any sense. So I think getting laughing at yourself is just an opportunity to get better.
Yeah. No, what a great way to look at it. Yeah. I remember when we talked to Carl Woods, I just finished talking. I was like, this isn't just like a skill acquisition approach. You know, this is how he lives his life. And I think with you too as well, it's just so clear that it's who you are. It's the way you go through the world. And it's not just a job, right? And it just comes across so clearly. And I think it's why you guys are so great at what you do. So I hope people go to emergent movement, MVMT.com. Because there's so much good stuff on there.
We wanted Emergence, but it was already taken. So we went with emergent, MVMT.com. So emergent movement. And one last thing I will share will be, you mentioned Carl, and that is the first thing is it's a worldview. It's not just a sport view. It's a worldview. It underpins human behavior. It underpins how we go about moving through the world, or knowing as we go, you know, to borrow from Carl and the wayfinding example and ideas. So that to me was one of the most refreshing things when I realized, like, oh my gosh, like this changes the entire way I behave in the world, and obviously how I go about my craft. But yes, thank you so much, John, and to Andrew for having us on. This has been a lot of fun. And I can speak for Sean and say this has been a lot of fun. And then yes, for the listeners out there, feel free to interact with any of our content. We greatly appreciate all the support, and thank you so much.